Hello, and welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Sickle, the stories-based podcast that interviews professionals, donors, and thought leaders in the field of fundraising. My conversation with Kathy was originally intended to be focused around approachability and accountability. You'll find out very quickly we delve into several other topics, including her STEM background, the importance of culture, and how she thinks about leadership in her role at Rice University. Kathy has some wonderful gems, and you're sure to get something out of this episode as we cover so many different topics that are important during COVID and beyond. Kathy Dantley Warren is the Vice President for Development and Alumni Relations at Rice University. Prior to her promotion in July 2019, she was Associate Vice President for Development at Rice. Prior to coming to Rice in July 2017, Kathy dedicated more than 3.5 years to Duke University's Duke Cancer Institute as their Senior Executive Director of Development. From 2010 to 2014, Kathy served as Assistant Dean for Alumni Affairs and Development at Cornell University's College of Engineering, where she developed and implemented its first Alumni Affairs and Development Strategic Plan and Alumni Engagement Plan. Kathy earned an MA in Cell and Molecular Biology and Microbiology from Duke University and a BA in Biology from Hampton University. Originally from Alexandria, Virginia, Kathy, her husband Stephen, son Bennett, and dogs Pearl and Tyson have enjoyed making their home in Texas since coming to Rice. She is an avid sports enthusiast and dog rescue advocate who also enjoys cooking and painting. Now let's learn from Kathy. Kathy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Why don't we start right out with approachability? Do you choose to be approachable? Because I've been told that you are very approachable. Is that something that you practice, or is it who you are?
It's definitely who I am. I think I get it from both. My parents come from large families. My dad could talk to and would talk to anyone. When I was getting older or in college, if I wasn't ready, there was always a gaggle, folks hanging out with my dad. So, you know, it's a little bit genetic. And I'm also a big introvert, so I actually love to listen. I'm a confluence of a few different things, but it's definitely who I am. And it just continues to be something that I try to espouse the older I get.
What are the things that you do or that you would advise others to do to signal approachability?
I think it's really hard, the busier you get, to be present in the moment. And the further you go up the professional ladder, the people are always looking to you. And I am an African-American woman, and there's not as many of us in this profession as well. So I'm extremely cognizant, too, of my visage, how I might appear to people. I happen to be a 6 foot tall person. I can look imposing. So I think I've always also been cognizant that.
Wait, are you 6 feet?
I'm almost 6 feet tall. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
And I've just always been aware, or increasingly aware, that I have to, you know, smile at people. I try to give people eye contact. I did a conference for CASE this past January. And I noticed that it seemed like the rest of the faculty were in constantly conversation. People weren't coming up to me. And I said something to one of the faculty members, and they said, "I think people are afraid to approach you. You're the conference chair." And so I said, "Oh gosh." So I was like, I must look too kind of focused on getting the conference done. It was my first time being the chair. So it's emotionally taxing, but I think it's important. And when I'm with my team, though, I always try to be aware. And if I see them on campus, which I know is not really how things are operating now, but to call them out and speak to them. And I've actually even very recently, in a course of a communication on after one of the virtual town halls that I did with my staff, had somebody acknowledge that, you know, the last time we were on campus, I saw her walking with 3 team members. I made a point of saying something. They always really appreciated that. So you just never know how those little things kind of go a long way. And this is something that happened literally 5 months ago, you know, or longer.
Well, how do you get to know your staff? That's a job in itself, right?
We I have about 130 report directly into our division, and then there's 25 or 30 folks who are in areas that are affiliated or have a dotted line. So we do a myriad of things. We have, you know, sort of official town halls and quarterly division meetings. We had just done my first retreat before all of this happened in early February. We have a lot of different engagement activities that happen across the division, even now in a virtual setting. And I try to show up when I can as well. So I'm seeing faces and talking to people in many different contexts. For instance, on Monday, someone facilitated a conversation about integrity, which is one of Rice's values. And it's something that I absolutely would list as one of my own values. And so I jumped in. It was a really beneficial conversation. And actually some of it, you know, kind of helped me as I thought about what we might talk about today.
I think there's always the push and the pull of, is it worth the time and the investment of resources to be putting these things on when you could be spending your time working on a $50 million gift or working with the president or doing something else? I mean, what's your answer to that? Like, why is culture important and why do you invest in it?
It does take a balance. I think especially in this first year, we're preparing for a campaign. So of course, there's a lot of activity around that. We are doing really well, but we are still in the silent phase. And so not derailing that train at all, in fact, preparing for the momentum to get larger, I also felt, especially in the first year, my tenure, it was important for me to invest, especially in the culture of the people, because we were expanding, we were about to expand again for the campaign, you know, doing some more hiring and things like that. So I affirmed and told my team publicly, I said, I think I have to spend a significant amount of time in this context as well as in campaign preparation, because if I don't, the things that'll ramp up when we launch will be more external and all that kind of stuff. I will be spending more time there. So I want to have that social and political capital with the group so that I know, I knew that that's my charge. Culture is not for them to define in absentia of me. As the new leader, I needed to define for them what that is. So in this past year, that's been a huge part of what I focused on.
You've been laying a foundation.
Exactly, because I knew I would not be able to give as much attention to it, and I wanted to make sure that we would be secure in our team culture, have some things that have their own momentum to them.
And so you've mentioned that you're in your first year on the job. You were at Rice before, but is the culture that you're working to build coming off of what you sort of inherited, or have you brought new ideas in from other experiences?
It definitely comes from what we inherited. We inherited a very collaborative, communicative, fun group. But what I was wanting to impart was an intentionality to our collaborativeness and more transparency about who we are, what we're trying to accomplish, what each of the teams do, because they were getting bigger and more externally facing. I was also trying to impart a sense of kind of leveling of the playing field. There was some lingering sense of, well, you know, the principal gifts team is more important than the major gifts team. And this hierarchical, some of stuff you know, it happens in our shop. But I was really trying to mitigate that.
Culture is ever growing and evolving. You can't just say something and then walk away, right? Exactly. It has to be constantly taken care of. And
exactly. What I actually realize is I'm saying culture, but I'm really saying people. You know, I'm mm-hmm. trying to take care of the people who do this work, to create a healthy environment for them to do the work in, because it sustains the organization. It's also, I mean, culture, I've read it described as sort of the immune system of the organization. And so I wanted us to have a healthy immune system because we're already collaborative and functional and really productive. But if, you know, the proverbial crap were to hit the fan, I wanted us to have a strong immune system. And guess what? You know, March.
It did.
crap hitting fan. I think this is defined as that. And so we literally had, I mentioned that retreat, had that retreat February 10th, invited those partners to end the day, focused, and a lot of it was around culture and the concepts of it, and, you know, did the usual things you do, break into teams. We use the DISC tool as a foundation for that. And then, you know, 5 weeks later, we're all working remotely. It was a strong foundation that allowed us, when we had to communicate with the team about what was happening and, you know, all the changes on campus and the changes to our hiring situation and budget, we had a different trust foundation upon which to build. And then, you know, we really were deliberate in continuing to build that, to make sure that then what we did wasn't eroding that. The investment was timely and certainly worth it. And recent surveys that we've done, you know, since we've been in remote working, are showing that there is a really positive sense amongst the team and a feeling of being cared for and supported. We're even able to be innovative and to think about this current fiscal year that we just started July 1, and not just sort of be surviving the pandemic and doing our work, but trying to think about, okay, what cool things can we do even given the constraints that we now have?
Exactly. This is going to sound like a funny question, but how do you maintain approachability on Zoom and virtually?
No, it's not funny at all. We have a lot of different engagement opportunities to support team communication in groups of different sizes. So I try to participate in those when I can, be intentional about it. I've still had, you know, one-on-one kind of mentoring / I want to check in with this person, you know, from a professional sense. And even in this environment, we are using primarily Zoom, but we also have the WebEx platform, which is integrated. There are a few people who have said some things to me about like something they're going through, you know, and I might check in on them and say, hey, you know, thinking about you or praying for you, if they have shared that with me and they know that I'm comfortable saying that.
Now, are these your direct reports or are these?
No, some of these folks are, you know, junior staff who have had someone seek me out to tell me about a death in the family, not COVID related. And so I've checked in on them periodically. Like I said, mentoring conversations that I've initiated, you know, with staff members that, you know, I understood, you know, something was happening with them. And so, you know, I wanted them to know that I'm available to them too. So it's difficult. I mean, if I replicated that 130 times and tried to do that, you know, all in a week, I can't, of course. There's definitely a finite window and time and of things that I can do or amount of things that I can do. I can be winding down at the end of the day and remember to hop on WebEx chat feature and just send a quick note to somebody. That doesn't take me 30 seconds to say, hey, how's it going?
Yeah, so it's a reminder that those little things actually aren't a huge investment. You can just send that off and it makes someone's day.
Exactly. Yep, exactly.
What is the return on investment of cultivating this culture? Do you actually think that the people that you're checking in on who are perhaps more devoted to Rice or to their jobs as a result are actually putting forward better performance? Is there a correlation, do you think?
There's two things I will say. I do think that because when we are then talking just sort of purely about like a business related objective, and we can have a more efficient and effective conversation about what we're trying to do, because I've spent the time with the team to build communication, you know, channels, to establish trust, to understand what motivates this person, make sure we're all on the same page about who we are as an organization, that we're all mission driven, et cetera, et cetera. Then I can kind of get to the crux of what it is we're trying to do a lot quicker. and, you know, not spin cycles and spin wheels on, you know, this, you know, we said we're going to do this. We didn't do this. Why didn't this happen? Oh, let me analyze this. And you realize that you all kind of weren't even communicating from a common place and didn't have kind of common trust with which to do it. March 16th, went to remote work. You know, since then, we've done 92 virtual events that have reached over 8,000 attendees from 46 different countries and 47 states.
Wow.
So that is, you know, a whole shift in the alumni relations group, the communications team, you know, other members of the team, technical support, all this kind of stuff. All of those things happen because that group could shift and pivot, because they have healthy working relationships, they have healthy communication structures.
And that really is how global RICE is too.
Exactly. We just finished the process of doing annual plans for, there's 14 different teams within the division. So like stewardship or alumni outreach or marketing communications. Annual fund. So each team had to do an annual plan. Now some teams, you know, sit and do planning on their own, or some teams that are extremely metrics driven, like the annual fund. Of course, you know, they define some goals and, you know, we define objectives for, let's say, major gifts, but every single team, the IT group, the data services group, the stewardship group, the volunteer management group, the marketing communications group, every single team had to do an annual plan. This year, we started that. I announced that after we went remote. I gave folks a deadline of June 1, and I just shared all of those plans with the entire division today. As a matter of fact, they all have this sense of transparency into what is happening that they've never had before. We've never done a strategic plan. I said we've never done a holistic annual planning process, and I'm very proud of the team for starting this in late April, early May, having drafts done by June in the midst of trying to close a fiscal year, and oh, by the way, still figuring out how to work remotely. Mm-hmm. And then producing something that we could share across the division just now. So I think those are two examples, one more quantitative and one more kind of qualitative, that show what I think is the measure of investing in building a culture, investing in, hey, I want to do an annual planning process because we said it's important that we're clear and transparent. We're, as an organization, we're all kind of putting our cards on the table. And this is what that looks like. And so we could work through where we had people who were sort of putting up a little bit of resistance. Why do I have to do this? Is this really going to be helpful? It's like,
It's actions following words.
Exactly. Again, it's important. It's part of the culture. I said, you know, I challenged you. I tell you guys, one of the things I say to them, I have little sayings, like I always say, do it afraid, right? And fail, learn, in time you learn to fail better. This is for us to try. We're going to mess up. We're going to learn from how we've messed up. And next year we'll do it better.
What inspired you to do the annual plan across the organization?
I want our groups to have a clearer sense of direction. I want the leadership group to have a clear sense of understanding. It's not to say that every mid-level manager below the quote-unquote leadership group needs to know what every other group is doing, but if they're curious, or if they, you know, they want to grow as a professional in development, maybe they're looking a larger level of responsibility, or maybe they want to make a switch from one area to the other. This is a window into what's happening.
That's really exciting. And I think the other thing that your staff will probably enjoy is that it will make it easier to celebrate and see success because you have these benchmarks now.
Yeah, I hope so.
You telling us about the annual plan was the perfect segue for us to move into accountability and data. So the goals are a perfect example of how you hold your staff accountable, but what are other ways that you do so, and how do you hold yourself accountable?
We just, that's hard. We had a conversation, I think I mentioned on integrity yesterday, which really comes down to self-accountability. So, and you realize just how hard that is. As you said, we just went through this planning. We have global kind of goals. And I should say, in our goal setting, I ask people, what are their top 3 to 5 objectives? And then for each objective, I said, let's think about these in terms of themes for what we do. So, and kind of broadly put five different categories of themes, one of which was culture, organizational culture, fundraising, engagement, just basic business process. And then because we just implemented a new database 2 years ago, there's still a lot of work that we're doing to completely transition into that new environment. It's called AlConnect. So I asked people to think about their objectives and when they touched on a theme to just note that, so we can kind of have a sense for how are we doing in each of these areas.
Do you have your own career coach?
I do. I do work with a coach in that process. I'm about halfway through a coaching process, and that's actually kind of exactly where I am, is working with her on kind of ways to go about goal setting when you're doing it from as an executive, having a lot more complex things that are kind of under your purview.
Right. Who are your mentors? Do you call on people to talk through these things with?
I have a cabinet of folks that I know I can go to that I've collected over the years. I'm also meeting new people in, having ascended to this role as a vice president. So now I'm part of the Case 50. I have not done this very often, and we've only met in person, I guess, twice. And now we've been having virtual calls, but I've started to kind of make mental notes of people who are doing things that I think I should ask that person about X, When I'm being intentional and when I have more time, I do try to make a point of identifying people to reach out to ask certain things. So between the mentors that are people that have have been with me throughout my career, I will definitely call on them. There are new folks and new peers and friends in the industry, certainly ones who aren't the VP level, that as well, that I will touch base with and just sound check stuff.
Do you want to give any shout outs?
I will shout out Sarah Rubin, who is at Ohio State, who I worked with at Hopkins and worked with at Cornell. I will shout out a former provost who was here at Rice, who's now at Notre Dame as provost, who's just been incredibly supportive. I'll shout out my good friend who is a assistant dean at a college in NC State in development, that we talk all the time. So it doesn't have to be just development folks, folks in academia, folks who don't have. Yeah. So it's just, I shout out members of my staff that I've gone to and have said, hey, I'm thinking about something, and this is really more your area of expertise. The answers come from a myriad places. Obviously, experience is so invaluable. There's plenty of knowledge and know-how.
Sometimes it's like it has to be the right day, right? For everything to click, and it's just a matter of the energy in the room or on the call, on the Zoom call. You mentioned the Case 50. It's so exciting that you're part of that group. Also, though, I haven't mentioned that you have a background in STEM. Do you think you're the only VP in the Case 50 with a background in STEM?
There's not that many. It's very, very rare. Yes, yeah. I have a master's degree in cellular molecular biology with a concentration in microbiology. So that's certainly extremely rare. When I entered development, I thought it was absurd that I was doing this, and that was probably the most asked question in interviews, and I still get it. I mean, people look at me, like the first thing I walk in, or if I, am somewhere, I'm being interviewed or whatever, I walk in a room and they just go, I have to ask you this question. I know exactly what they're going to ask me. And it's been 21 years. It's not just, sort of being comfortable with data, but it's asking questions, kind of the why behind what we're doing. Is it really sound? Just because we did something, is that the cause behind the effect that we got? It certainly informs my comfort with information. It informs my way of approaching a problem. And do I really know that what I'm doing is going to yield, and it is going to have the outcomes that I want, just because I'm doing it?
And how you mentioned in the beginning of the conversation being an African-American woman, how do you think that, you know, makes you different in terms of thinking about committing to diversity on your staff and, you know, issues of diversity and inclusion moving into this year with the national conversation?
It's really been extremely humbling and kind of emotionally challenging experience to think about doing this work as an African-American female, you know, at an institution that was, when it started, did not admit people who looked like me. My father had me when he was at an advanced age. He was 63 when I was born, but race didn't admit people who looked like us until he was 55. So it is a profound thing for me to think about leading an organization where I am, I mean, you know, with that setup in terms of accessibility to it and the role that I now have, and
it's incredible, you know,
how people, so and within our team, I have led the launch of a diversity, equity, inclusion task force, members of senior leadership. My second in command is in charge of defining kind of the direction for this group, setting goals for it. We have had some initial things that we have enacted and delivered on, but we are still about to set goals for the year. And so I know that amongst my team, there's many, and certainly not just the people of color or the African Americans on the team, who are saying, well, what is this really going to mean across the board? There are a lot of people who are asking this question. So back to the accountability issue, I've said, no, we will have goals and actual, you know, achievable outcomes for this group. And we're going to communicate about those so people can see what we're about and hold us accountable. And so it's personally powerful for me, given that it's who I am. I'm the mother of a 14-year-old son who happens to be 6'6". So I'm, you know, getting really personal and deep, but I worry about his safety all the time. And it's very powerful to me because I'm leading an organization at an institution like Rice within a profession, which has just traditionally not been accessible. And so I think on a number of levels, I am trying to make an impact. I am still determining what that is. Mm-hmm. But it is a very personal question. And I don't know if you said this, but yes, I'm the only African-American female in the whole Case 50. And really, Case 50 is more like 75 or 80 people. I'm the only one. And so it's very daunting to kind of look across that group and think, what is my responsibility here? What's the mark I want to leave? How do I contribute to this conversation? How do I lead in this conversation? As you can hear,
does it feel like a weight, or does it?
Of course.
Okay. So it's less empowering than it is.
It's very much a weight. So I think we're all only called to do what we're all only called to do. And that none of us are given more than we can actually do. And each of us is also given resources, allies, strengths. We're also given inspiration to get through. When you find yourself in a situation, asking why isn't actually valuable, you know, but setting intention and thinking about what you can accomplish millimeter by millimeter, action by action, that is what your charge is. So yes, it does feel like a weight, but that's how I deal with it. You know, you asked about my coach earlier, talking to her about this. She's not African-American, but she was, you know, she said something really powerful in the midst of the response to George Floyd. Well, actually, but none of us have actually been here in this moment, trying to lead in this moment. And that is true. That is true. So you do what you can, and you're compassionate with yourself about the fact that you can only do what you can do.
You know, I've had several variations of this conversation with different guests, and I think what we're trying to figure out now is how to grow, develop, and empower more people like you so that you aren't the only one.
Yeah.
And I know there are people listening right now who are super inspired by everything you just shared. So every conversation moves it forward.
Agree. Absolutely agree. We don't know who will touch or inspire. And I think you're inviting me to have this conversation is just, you know, out of the blue. And I'm getting, you know, I get asked to do more of these and I learn so much, you know, because your questions tell me kind of what's out there, what people are thinking. I do have people often come to me after I speak and ask me another question or say, wow, you are, you know, I didn't know you would be open to me reaching out to you. And so it's a, you know, perpetuating hopefully a virtual cycle of connecting people, enhancing our profession, of addressing these issues of injustice and inequity. So, I mean, in this little way, if I'm helpful, I'm grateful. And certainly I'm grateful to you for starting this podcast. So thank you for doing your part.
Thank you. Well, this has been so much fun to have you. And I loved all the topics that we covered. They're evergreen. I would love to end with my signature question, which is, Kathy, what do you know for sure?
I know for sure what I just said about doing your part. We are often confronted with things that seem we don't have the answers to the questions, but the journey is about pursuit of the answers. The journey is about doing what we do know and being open to divine inspiration to do better, being open to conversations with people like you that help us know to do better. That I know is going to make us better individuals and make us better contributors to society. So that's what I know for sure.
Well, thank you so much. I'm going to try to remain open next week to the process.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks a lot, Catherine. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Kathy's commitment to culture, growing her team, creating a healthy work environment, and hitting goals with data and metrics seems unstoppable. Thanks for listening. And of course, you can always connect on LinkedIn or on Instagram through the account at devdebrief. And you can always email me at devdebrief@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and have a great week.